All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. I hope everybody enjoyed those first two segments with Dana Lyons. Now, as promised, we're going to shift our focus even more so to the precious metals and even talk about some of the underlying precious metal stocks as we're chatting with Brian London. Brian is the editor of the Gold Newsletter, also our host down at the New Orleans Investment Conference happening this year, November 2nd through the 5th. I will post a link in the show notes for the weekend show so all of you can learn more about that conference. Hopefully join us down in New Orleans at the beginning of November. Brian, talking about the gold market, we're recording this on Friday, and gold, silver, precious metals broadly are fading to end the week. Gold right now just below 3,300. Again, still a strong level, and gold has been consolidating in a tighter and tighter range. I think a lot of people looking to early July or even mid-July is a decision point for gold. Is it going to break higher? Is it maybe going to give up some of these gains? But overall, $3,300 gold has been very strong. And this whole bull market in gold, or in the precious metals, let's say, has really been led by gold. Gold was leading to start off. Gold was breaking out ahead of other precious metals. Silver has started to play a little catch up. And the underlying equities, the majors, were leading the charge. We saw a little bit of trickle of money into the juniors, but that has also faded over the last about week and a half. So, Brian, when it comes to this precious metals bull market, as you and I were chatting off, Mike, this is the best market I've seen for precious metals in over 20 years, really dating back to kind of the tail end of that historic run that ended right around 2011. But, Brian, what's your takeaway from the way this bull market is playing out for the precious metals?
Thanks, Corey. Yeah, and you are absolutely right to stand in astonishment at this gold bull market. It's been absolutely remarkable. And my argument has been that it's absolutely unprecedented. It's unique in the history of gold bull markets. Now, there's only been a few gold bull markets, you know, since 1971. But still, this one is unique. And it is unique for the primary reason that it was started and has been driven largely by central bank buying. And this has resulted in a couple of things. One, because the buying has been strategic and not according to the shifting emotions of investors, the corrections in this market have been much shallower and shorter than traditional technical analysis would have predicted. The other thing that's really unique about this market is because central banks have driven it and central banks don't buy mining stocks and they don't buy silver, these two traditional levers to gold have been late to the party and sporadically involved when they have leveraged gold. That has changed, though, in a good bit. It's changed this year so far. In the first quarter, the only sector out of all the investment sectors out there, stocks, bonds, all the subsectors, the only asset class or sub or sector to beat gold's performance was mining stocks. Gold went up about 16% in the first quarter. Mining stocks about doubled that return. And they've continued to do that. Now, what's interesting, and I think what you've gotten at, is the fact over the past month or 6 weeks or so, we started to see the junior market wake up. Not only was it the big majors, but that filtering down the food chain that we had hoped for and that we've seen in every previous bull market environment was starting to happen. If you plot the Toronto Venture Exchange Index, which is not the best proxy, not the perfect proxy for the junior mining sector, but a pretty good one. If you plot the venture index against the big GDX gold miners index, you can see that the venture index, and by proxy, the junior miners, started to outperform the big miners sometime around mid-April to the end of April. And they traded sideways for a while, but recently they've actually begun to outperform the GDX or the big miners once again. That is precisely the kind of environment we want to see. And, you know, in addition to this quantitative evidence that we're seeing, qualitatively, you know, we were talking about how many financings we're seeing that are coming out as bought deals at good prices with very little, if any, warrant coverage, and just and a financing environment that has really perked up.
Well, Brian, I think it's an interesting environment for sure when you consider that when you go all the way back to 2018, towards the end of that year in October, November, that's really when some of the best in breed gold producers started moving higher. If you go back that far, that's when K92 and IAM Gold and Wesdome and Agnico Eagle and Alamos Gold, that's when they actually started running, was back in 2018. But it took until last year in 2024 until the rest of the gold producers started waking up because their margins started expanding so much. So even though there was a big run in place that had been happening for years in tandem with gold's rise, it took till last year till we got over 2,100. And really, it took till we got up to 2,500, 2,600, 2,700 before you saw the gold producers really start getting more momentum. Now, this year, as you highlighted in Q1, we saw the rest of the sector finally wake up because gold was over 3,000. Are you surprised that it took as long as it did and that it took over $3,000 gold to really get the animal spirits going? And now that silver is up over 35 and we've got that part of the spectrum going, are you surprised it took this long?
Not really, but you know, I'm not surprised because of what we just discussed as to why this bull market began and how it began and how it was fueled, you know, by central banks. I would not have predicted that involvement by central banks to that degree, at least. But you know, events overwhelm everything else. If you look at when the central bank buying began, it was in the spring of 2022 after Russia invaded Ukraine and after the Allies came up with all their sanctions, and central bankers began to realize that they too could at some point in the future be victimized by such a US-led coalition, or you know, by anyone in the US or any administration in the US that so wished. So they began just hedging their bets with gold. China was a big part of that, and we know we have a good feeling what their motivations are and have been consistently. So yeah, it kind of started in 2022. And what's interesting to me is that prior to Russia's invasion of Ukraine, we were getting a nice little run in gold. But that geopolitical event actually forestalled that kind of nascent gold bull market because gold ran up on the eve of the invasion, and after a week or so, it ran right back down, and people conflated the rise in gold with the geopolitical issues, and we began a fairly steady downtrend from there. So, you know, it is interesting that it has taken this long, but I understand why it happened, even though I didn't predict the events that led to it happening.
Brian, the one thing that really stands out to me is how much debt is on everyone's radar right now. I know that in the gold community, people have been talking about debt really ever since I came into the community, a little over 2 decades ago, but now it seems to matter a lot more. And it seems to be even more so talked about on both aisles in politics. In the US, Trump came in saying he was going to get debt under control with the big, beautiful bill. That seems to be the opposite of what's happening, where debt is just continuing to expand. And this is all happening when the economy is doing pretty well, too, when you would think that they might be trying to get their house in order. But now, as I said, both sides of the aisle are talking about it. Clearly, much more focus on this, even though I'm sure when we get to the debt ceiling, it'll get raised and raised again. But how big of a change have you noticed this being where mainstream media right now, who does like to beat up on Trump, so he's giving them a reason to beat up on him because of what he ran under being getting the debt under control, not getting it under control. But now a lot more people are talking about it, and that is a key driver when you price gold in US dollars.
Yeah, you know, the gold bug, the sound money community, and my many, many years of being involved with it, one thing I've noticed is that they're often so far ahead of the crowd that they're essentially wrong. You know, our friend Rick Rule says that in investing, the synonym for early is wrong. And yes, we've been talking about this for a long time about how the debt is getting out of control. I've been hearing really smart people talk about it for decades and nothing happened. But about 5 or 6 years ago, I looked at the numbers and realized that it really was getting out of control and becoming an issue, and started talking about it an awful lot in Gold Newsletter. Now my voices and our voices have been joined by a chorus of really well-respected people on Wall Street. You know, you've got Ray Dalio, you've got Gundlach, you've got Tudor Jones, you've got so many people talking about it now. And yet the only way this subject gets talked about in the major financial media is when these people are being interviewed. And you can see their interviewers, their eyes just glaze over because they can't conceive of anything happening. But the bottom line is these experts, these well-renowned figures, it's not just that they're getting to be old curmudgeons like some of us in the gold bug community. The numbers really are that outrageous. After 45 years of ever easier money and ever easier debts, the debt load today is so great that it can't be handled. It can't be handled without the entire budget and financial house of cards collapsing at interest rates that are anywhere near normal. In fact, the dollars that make up that debt have to depreciate at a faster rate than the rate of interest being paid on the debt. That means that interest rates have to be below the rate of inflation going forward, or everything falls apart. In short, we need negative real rates going forward, essentially forever. And that's what I believe is one of the primary issues, if not the primary issue, that's driving gold over the long term. I think in addition to all these titans of Wall Street we're talking about that are recognizing this, I think governments are recognizing this. Yes, the invasion of Ukraine and the sanctions environment has them desirable of some independence from the dollar hegemony. But also they are realizing that there's a world of hurt coming up. There's some sort of a reset of all that debt, not just in the U.S., but throughout all developing economies, that has to happen. And in that environment, he who owns the gold has the power. So I think that is, you know, fundamentally at bottom, one of the primary driving factors behind this central bank buying of gold.
Yeah, Brian, you said it well, and I think it's great that you also pointed out that it's not just the U.S., that all nations are doing the same thing, and that they've inflated their way out of their problems and papered over their problems for so long that really most nations have an untenable amount of debt. We've been saying for two decades that the math is the math, and it was already unpayable. Now it's really unpayable, so the only way to deal with it is to deal with some kind of financial reset. But that's just the driver in gold. I want to shift it over to look what's happening in silver, which, again, central banks aren't buying silver. Look what's happening in copper, back over $5. Look what's happening in platinum. Central banks aren't buying platinum, but it's at 13-year highs right now. So you're seeing a reflation trade in a lot of these commodities, in the precious metals, in base metals. You're seeing critical minerals on the map. There seems to be an environment where, through executive orders or through national focus in Europe, in China, in the U.S., really globally, that countries realize they need to start sourcing more raw materials. So maybe speak to what's happening besides just the gold bug narrative. There's a commodity reflation trade going on across the board here.
Yeah, there is. There is, coincidentally, and, you know, to our great delight, there are actually two mega trends happening in mining and metals. One is in the monetary metals, gold and silver, for the reasons we just talked about. The other is base metals, and I throw platinum and palladium, the PGMs in general, into the base metal category because I don't really believe they carry much of a monetary cachet any longer. But that's a totally different story. Whatever level of global economic growth we have is increasing what has already been a very steep demand curve for base metals, and copper is a primary beneficiary of that because you can't really innovate around copper in electrical usages. So the EV story, the rebuilding of electrical grid, the emergence of emerging economies that want all of the conveniences and that the developed world has, will put just the steepest demand curve we may have ever seen for any commodity on base metals in general, but copper in particular. And at the same time, we have had decades of underinvestment in the sector. In a sector where it takes 20 years for a discovery to become a mine, for a copper mine, there's not really a very effective way for the market response to come in. And that puts even greater pressure on prices. And we're just starting to see that in copper. Platinum is a supply-demand story as well, with really falling stocks on the major exchanges and a supply-demand pinch that's going to be quite dramatic, and it's developing to be quite dramatic. So we're very fortunate as investors in this sector that we've got both of these stories going for us.
So Brian, let's get into a little bit more of the equities, especially on the gold front. I'm curious your thoughts on this, where back at the peak of the last market, 2011, majors were out there buying, it seemed like almost everything. They were going down the food chain, they were buying lower margin, higher cost projects. Now they're not doing that. But what we're seeing in the junior and mid-tier space is that these guys are bringing these projects online. I'm seeing some all-in sustaining costs in the $25, $26, $2,700 region. So they are still making money at these levels, but it's not the majors buying them out. It's these other companies bringing these mines online or even acquiring some of these mines that haven't made money in years, maybe even decades. Now they are making money. But again, they're high-cost assets. They're not tier one assets. How are you seeing this environment where the majors are staying disciplined? They're focusing, if not just on tier one assets, on other metals outside of gold, but now it's the mid tiers and some of the juniors that are running these high cost mines. They're at least making money right now, but they're not giving themselves a whole lot of wiggle room if we do get any sort of a significant correction.
Yeah, some of those costs are actually the costs of capital, which I think are going to start to come down as more generalists come into the sector. You know, the big miners have been sitting on their hands and trying to show discipline so that they can be called, you know, good stewards of shareholder capital and all this other stuff at the various industry cocktail parties and on Wall Street. Eventually, though, one thing we know is that they're going to start spending money like drunken sailors. On the junior end of the spectrum, they're just getting sick and tired of waiting around for the majors to come in and buy them at some ridiculous premium. Only the very best, the finest, the world-class projects are getting bought out at significant premiums. So if you're a junior explorer, developer, and you've got a great project, you have to keep working, you have to keep financing, you have to keep justifying your job. So that means if the majors aren't going to buy you out, you have to progress along that path toward production and act like you're going to bring it into production. In a lot of cases, if not the majority of cases, these companies actually do have that as their fallback plan. So you might as well do it correctly and to your best of your ability and hire the expertise that you need. In some cases, we've seen that result in the fact that these projects actually go into production because they just keep de-risking, and there you go. So yeah, it is interesting. I think the majors are going to come back into the sector, but because we've seen these mergers of the majors, there's not as many big players out there. And what we're actually seeing are these mid-tiers evolving and merging and advancing along that path to where they will soon be considered majors themselves. And they are, you know, as you go down the food chain, you get greater and greater levels of you know, aggression in the market where they are more incentivized to go out and do things and aren't as content to just sit on their hands. So yeah, it's interesting. It's evolving in a slightly different way than we've seen in past bull markets. But I think human nature is what it is and always has been. And at some point, these majors will start, the ones that are left at least, will start getting into bidding wars for the best assets.
Well, Brian, just to that point about the M&A cycle and what we've seen in prior cycles where they end up overpaying at the top, we haven't really seen that so far this time. We did see a lot of M&A in 2023 and 2024. So far this year, we've seen a few deals, but you would think at these gold prices and the value of the ounces in the ground that developers have delineated over the last decade or so, that you'd be seeing a dozen deals a month, and we're not. So you're a betting man, Brian. Do you bet that the developers get revalued higher before the mid-tiers move on them? Or is it a situation where we start seeing waves of M&A before those companies can get revalued? Because right now there's a nice arbitrage between producers and developers. What do you think happens first?
Yeah, I think the first actors, the first majors to go in and scoop up some of these developed or developers in their projects, they're going to get the best prices, and that's going to spark the re-rating that we'd like to see. And we may see some generalists come in and just say that the mining sector is stupid, look at the numbers on these projects, and provide the capital themselves. Starting to see some signs of that, but we'll see if that happens. So yeah, I think the first ones out there are going to get the best prices, and eventually the ones that can hold out the longest will get the best valuations for the shareholders of the developers.
So, Brian, where do you think the best opportunities are right now for investors that either want to rotate some money out of maybe their high-flying stocks or out of other sectors into the resource stocks, gold stocks, or for those people that just have cash on the sidelines saying they want a piece of this action? Where's the best opportunities?
Yeah, I continue to be very positive, as Shad mentioned, on those companies that have great projects. They have economics on them, perhaps. They have very large resources, you know, and they're selling for still extraordinarily low valuations per ounce in the ground. That said, you know, I'm a sucker for a good exploration play. We have a few of those in our Gold Newsletter portfolio that I'm excited about. I found myself, I don't know if it's a matter of strategy or just good fortune and coming across some good stories, but I found myself adding some copper exploration development plays to our Gold Newsletter portfolio over the last couple of months, two in our July issue that's just come out. And I guess I have to say it's more of serendipity finding these plays that have managed to get really good land positions in some of the best and most highly prospective and well-known copper belts in the world. And with great targets. So I'm excited about some of those, but I guess that's more of not just a strategy to play off the strong copper prices. It is just coming across some really good exploration companies at the right time.
Hey, even some of those are moving very nicely. And now, man, almost every exploration company is cashed up. I'm sure there's going to be a lot of news coming out in the back half of this year. Hopefully, the market keeps rewarding that good news because it has been now for a little while, but especially in May, boy, oh boy, did we see a whole lot of interest come into those juniors up 50, 60, 70% in a matter of a couple weeks. Now they're fading a little bit, but overall, still a very, I think, healthy and strong environment for precious metals, but hey, something we will stay on top of. Everyone, thanks for tuning in, spending time with us on your weekend. Be sure to go back, check out our website, podcast, YouTube channel, and Substack page. Just search DKE Report, where you can listen to all our daily editorials, market updates, and company interviews. Brian, thanks again for joining us. And remember, click that link in the show notes to learn more about that New Orleans Investment Conference. I hope you all have a great rest of your week.
The Cortland Economics Report is produced for A.B. Cortland and Associates. Opinions expressed on this program are intended solely for the entertainment of our listeners, do not constitute investment advice, and are not necessarily those of this network, radio station, or our sponsors. Find out more about this program and today's guests by visiting www.kereport.com. For Al Cortland, this is Colleen Robbins. Join us again next week for the Cortland Economics Report.